Well, so last time, finally officially did transfine and recursion the form given an operation. Oh, just a manner of speaking. So we say something about how to produce things. We can get, i.e. say, an operation H such that for all ordinals alpha H of alpha is defined. And hence, H of beta is defined, all beta less than alpha. So H restricted to alpha exists, is a function, is a set, whatever. Alpha is defined, and it's simply the result of this operation applied to the object, which is simply everything that came before. Okay. Again, I guess I was saying this last time, but just to write it out, H restricted to alpha is simply the restriction of this to that. In terms of the functional notation, it's got domain alpha, all the beta that came before, and it simply is telling us those values. Okay. So, given that, and proved it last time, I mentioned the debt from chapter 2, debt to chapter 6, for all sets A, there is an ordinal alpha such that A is equinumerous with alpha. Want to prove it. We want to do a transfinite recursion. So the intuitive argument build a beta less than sum to be determined ordinal gamma by given say a beta less than alpha if A does not equal this, then pick some A alpha in A that we don't have yet. That has the form of this, although we probably should do some things to make it fit, and there is that word pick, which, depending on your state, a relationship with the axiom of choice, these are nice or not. But anyway, here's the intuitive argument. Eventually, we run into an ordinal alpha such that A equals the set of A beta such that beta is less than alpha. So the function A beta less than alpha is 1, 1 and onto A. A is therefore equinumerous with alpha. So we simply run into the ordinal alpha for which we've, by picking, exhausted. Notice for the intuitive argument, so we'll then write down, you know, the formal argument explicitly using the axioms and stuff, and explicitly doing the recursion. But notice, by the way, this is just built on an argument that makes perfect sense in the situation of finite versus infinite. If you have a set, you could carry out this argument in the more familiar setting of only doing it not for ordinals beta, but for natural numbers, for little n's. You just keep picking elements from A and always pick a new one until finally you get an onto map. You'll either run into an integer in which you've got that A is equinumerous to the integer, so it's finite, or the whole process goes on for, quote, forever, you know, forever in the sense that you kind of learned in grade school through all the natural numbers, eternity. And that would produce not necessarily an onto map, but a 1-1 map from the integers, omega, 1-1 into A. Here we just move it to the transfinite, and implicit in what we're saying here, we will run into an ordinal because the sets just cannot hold out against them. There's too many ordinals, turns out. So that's the intuitive proof. So the explicit proof. Well, even to get started, there's a the above has an implicit, like almost all uses of the axiom of choice, use of the axiom of choice. Right here, pick. So just because you said the word pick doesn't necessarily guarantee the axiom of choice, but it's dangerous. And this is the type of thing you're picking. So let's see what we're actually saying. So i.e. claim, given a set A, there is a function f from what we seem to be operating here are on non-empty sets from the set of X contained in A such that X is not empty to A such that for all X, another way to say X is a subset of A and not empty is X is a subset of A and it's not the empty set. For all X in there, F of X is not just taking on a value, you know, inside A, but it's taking one inside the non-empty set X. And that seems to be what we're doing here. Here we have a set X. This is the same as saying that, you know, this part is the same as saying X is not empty. Okay, so we're using the axiom of choice here, claim, so proof. Again, it's the axiom of choice. How is the axiom of choice being used? For each X like this, we're picking a member of X. So let R be exactly that, X's and little a's, such that X is one of the ones mentioned. X is a subset of A, but it's not the empty set. Little a is a member of A, and in fact, more than that, little a is an X. That's the relation. Clearly, the domain of R, each X which is non-empty, subset of A, actually has an X. So the domain of R is all subsets of A except for the null set. Right? So, again, by axiom of choice, there is this one big function. I decided to call it capital F. It's a matter of mood which one you pick, contained in R such that the domain of F equals the domain of R. We identified the domain of R, so the domain of F is the power set of A with the null sets run away. So for all X in the power set of A minus the null set, we have the pair x, f of x is an R. So this is what we said about pairs that were an R. So f of x, the little a here, is a member of x. Okay, and that's all we claim, so da-da. So we've now got one object, this capital F, which can be referred to when we do the thing about pick it. That's basically how the axiom of choice says. Instead of saying picking that, we can simply say A alpha equals F of this non-empty set. So we've made at least this step a bit more precise. Okay, what else is going on here? Obviously, we're doing a transfer recursion, which I wrote down here, so I might as well keep that. Here I just went through one more example of how the axiom of choice. So one more example of a qual problem 4. Right? Notice how totally hidden. And again, there's a lot of stuff going on here, so we're kind of stretching it to, you know, make a transfinite recursion into a qual problem 4. But there's a whole bunch of stuff here. And the person doing math, the least of their worries is to point out, become conscious even, of the fact that they're using an axiom. You very seldom will see anybody, even in this course at this late date, basically saying, oh, look, we use the subset axioms. You know, you don't want to say you're using the axiom of choice. You just basically use it. And so here's how it's being used. If we point out how, there's this hidden function. We're trying to make it explicit here, so fine. So here's our intuitive argument. I just did the thing with the axiom of choice. I guess I can do this, can't I? So just in case you want to see it later, I'll do this. Let's see if I can get the proof. So we're just going to try to copy this proof. We want to do an operation. One typical thing here. Let's look at the other part happening here. We said here eventually we're going to run into an ordinal alpha such that, you know, we actually got all of A. The general form for transfinite recursion here doesn't brook anything like that. He doesn't care if you ran into that ordinal. You're supposed to keep going. So it's sometimes useful. In a transfinite recursion to have a default value. Here, any A in any A in A is a non-default value. That's the stuff we're trying to accumulate by the intuitive idea here. We just keep picking members of A. I should have said this up front, that the A betas were being picked inside A. Well, so don't notice remark A a set. There is a D, D for default, such that D is not in A. We kind of got this on the first day. There is no set of all sets. At the stage we're at, the simplest way to point this out is that a power set of A cannot be 1-1 embedded in A. So power set of A is not a subset of A. So there is a D in the power set of A, D not in A. So we've got a D. So let's fix D such that D is not an A. D equals our default. Okay? The next thing that will happen, looking at the form of transfinite recursion, no matter which one you're doing, you're always going to be iterating some operation that you yourself probably are picking, for the instance of transfinite, applied to the entire function telling you the entire set of values you've done previously. So the objects H restricted to alpha occurring in our recursion will be functions f with domain equal to alpha. It's up to us, though, what they're doing. So here, f will be a function from alpha to, we're trying, our intuition here says, just pick members of A, but we have to accommodate everything, so we'll set up a default to keep going, and the default was picked so we can distinguish between the two. If you're in A, you're not the default. If you're the default, you're not in A. So we can tell which one we are. Here, F will be a function from alpha to A union singleton D. So, and the key thing here will be, having said that, how do we carry out what's intuitively being said here in the form of one of these recursions? Well, if D is in the range of F, then intuitively, by which I just mean referring to the intuitive argument we've already sketched out, in the intuitive argument, then alpha maybe I shouldn't call it alpha. I already did, but I had a particular ordinal there too. Let's call it alpha prime. Then alpha prime has already gone too far, i.e., f of alpha equals the default for some alpha less than alpha prime, if D is already in the range. Right? If D is not in the range of F, then again, I'll say intuitively and hopefully, because at this point we haven't proved anything, truly F mapping alpha prime to A will be 1, 1. Let's see if I've summarized in some sense what's happening here. We pick A betas whenever possible. Whenever we haven't exhausted all of A, we pick a new one, which means since it's new, it won't equal any of the ones before. And so if we had a 1-1 function before, we're not violating it. A alpha is a new value. We keep doing until we're on to, at which point we stop, eventually run into the ordinal where we stop. We'll then give the default value. And so on, up until the default value, we will, as the argument intuitively has said, and hopefully in the sense that we're now trying to precisely write it out, hopefully that it will be a 1-1 function. Then intuitively, hopefully. All right. So having said all this, which is stuff that we're telling ourselves about what we're doing, we are producing things like this. And I didn't bother in the intuitive argument to mention what happens when we hit the ordinal that we want, because then we just start giving the default value. So this should help us specify the operation O in our case. What operation O are we talking about? Just like in the axiom of choice, there's a hidden capital function F and a hidden use of the axiom of choice. Here, there's an operation here. We are telling ourselves about an operation O here. I don't know exactly where to point, but we have the intuitive argument. So what are we telling ourselves to do? O of X should equal, the main case we have is this type of thing. So what's this say it? If X is a 1-1 function from A to A, and the range of X does not equal A, and this should be a little x, I guess. Little x does not, range of little x does not equal A. If that's the case, then we have this non-empty set, range of x not equal to A, so A minus the range of x is not empty. We have the axiom of choice being used to convert that to a new member of A. So we have specify the operation O, O of X equals what we want if our input is exactly the type of thing we expect to run into, and it's equaling to the default value otherwise. So we've specified an operation. We could try to prove things about our operation or the iteration of the operation we want, but we now can obviously quote transfinite recursion. So we get, which means i.e., we can say an operation H. And the transfinite recursion theorem is for us basically build in the fact that there's a way to say this thing. We don't actually have to be the one writing out that thing about acceptable functions, unique one, and blah, 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 which was the proof of this, the saying of this. So we get an operation H such that H of any alpha equals O of H restricted to alpha. Mm-hmm. All right. How should we prove things with about this stuff? Why not try to bring the thing into the same form that we did here? So, for each ordinal beta, if H of beta is in A, let's let H of beta equals A sub beta, because that was our intention. Okay? How about checking the 1-1-ness? Notice if for beta an ordinal, if A beta is an A, then A beta does not equal the default. We're picking the default not to be any of the reasonable things we could pick. Does not equal the default. Good. So, what do we get for free from that? The thing applied to it is that, but A beta equals H of beta equals our operation of H restricted to beta, and so that implies our operation restricted to beta is a 1-1 function from beta to A, 1-1 and not onto, right? It also guarantees that we pick it in a particular way. We're basically now repeating in the explicit language here what the intuitive argument was. So in order to actually do the repeat, I'll erase the explicit argument, although I probably could have saved time by cleverly keeping the appropriate part of it. But let's see. So if we haven't run into the default, then the function will have to be a 1-1 function from beta to a, not onto. Okay. Let's see. If the notice... If there is an alpha such that h of alpha equals the default, then there is a least such ordinal. Let alpha equal the least if it exists. Ordinal such that h of alpha equals the default. So, claim, just to tidy things up, if gamma is greater or equal, if gamma is greater than alpha, then h of gamma also equals the default, because we didn't care at that point, i.e., h restricted to gamma has range including d equaling h of alpha as an element. And so the main thing we want to be happening as we do our recursion stopped happening. We just have the default. Once we have the default itself maintains that we're not getting what we wanted, and so we continue to give the default value. All right. What about what's happening below alpha? Claim. If let's phrase it this way. If beta is an ordinal such that the default is not in the range of beta, then h restricted to beta, which equals now the a sub, say, delta less than beta. Why? We already pointed out if we had an ordinal, whenever we have an ordinal that's producing members of a, i.e. not the default value, then... what did I say here? So did I do that yet? Notice if for beta, so right. So that means h restricted to beta is a 1-1 function from here to there. If beta is an ordinal such that the default's not in the range of beta, then h of beta has to be equal to these things. Okay. I haven't said anything about the actual value at beta itself, and h restricted to beta is 1-1, is a 1-1 function from beta to a. The only issue would have to be whether it's 1-1, and I basically kind of already said here it was. I guess this go around, though, I just said that if we actually were producing at beta a member of a, the same thing happened before. Here I'm slightly going a bit farther. I'm considering beta such that, I don't know what's happening at beta, but earlier we haven't. So probably just that I wrote things down in a less succinct way, but that often happens here. So proof that it's 1-1. Proof, again, we already have, I don't know. Let's try to just tie in here. If... delta is less than beta prime is less than beta, then a sub beta prime is an a, so h restricted to, I already said it was 1-1, but I got to actually show that we're doing something to make it 1-1, then a beta prime is not only just an a, it's equal to f of a minus the range of h restricted to beta prime. So this is equal to f of a minus all those preceding values, delta prime less than beta prime. So a beta prime is not a member of this set. In particular, a beta prime does not equal a delta, which is one of these guys. So if delta is less than beta, a beta prime does not equal a delta. And I have to do this argument someplace. I decided to do it here. Namely, I'm just pointing out something that we're clearly doing as part of the recursion. We're picking new values of a betas to be different than the preceding values. Right? We could have done something a bit more succinct. Okay, so where are we? I haven't shown yet that there actually is an ordinal alpha like this that runs into the default thing. That was part of the intuitive argument that we just keep doing it until that happens. But we've shown that if we're either at that place or earlier, we're producing a 1-1 function. So the way the argument went, so again, what else? So if alpha exists, then by the above, h restricted to alpha is 1-1 from alpha to a, right? Since h alpha equals the default by definition of our operation, where are we? We're in a place where our x here is h restricted to alpha. It is a 1-1 function from a to a, right? And if it were not, its range were not equal to a, we would pick a new thing, but we didn't, a new element of a, we picked the default. Since a alpha by definition of o, if you look at the definition there, we're fulfilling all the clauses here. Except for this one. Must be that range of h restricted to alpha, that would be the x in the definition of O, not equal to, it must be that this clause fails. Because there's no other clause here now that can fail. The alpha we're at, we just examined those and all the ones earlier, and they produce 1-1 functions from, functions 2a. I don't particularly care what the domain is here. And so the only clause that doesn't, I wrote that down. It's not, they're not, nothing here is a function from a to a. It's all from ordinals to a. And in, to make the operation make sense, doesn't matter. The only clause that could go wrong is that, in fact, out of the intuition, we produce more and more elements of A until finally it fails that we haven't produced all of A, i.e. H restricted to alpha is onto A. All right? If alpha exists, then by the above, blah, 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 since H of alpha does equal default, by definition, H of alpha must be onto, and that then gives us what we want. H restricted to alpha maps alpha 1-1 onto A. So that's the recursion. Why does the recursion stop? Couple of ways to try to answer that here. The main one is that there's simply lots of ordinals. So why does such an alpha exist? Well, if not, by way of contradiction about, you know, why it exists, would have an operation H from all of the ordinals 1, 1, 2a. Why do we have that? The way I've done this, we pointed out that we have 1, 1 functions until we hit the default value. Why does such an alpha exist, i.e., why must there be an alpha such that H of alpha equals the default? If not, we never run into the default, and we have a 1-1 function, i.e., for all, say, delta less than, how did I say it, beta prime less than beta, H restricted to beta 1-1 implies that H of delta does not equal H of beta prime. And again, just another way of saying the intuition about what's going on, we're always picking a new member of A over all the preceding ones that we had. So we happen to put 1-1 onto A. We claim that's impossible. And the simplest argument by the replacement axioms we have that for all ordinals alpha, or ordinals, since there is no alpha, like I said there, for all ordinals beta, there is, well, let's try it the other way by replacement axiom. For let B be the set, be, well, technically this is a class, the class H of beta, beta and ordinal. This is not a very good description of this class for purposes of trying to say it's a set. It's indexed by ordinals, but B equals this. This is a subclass of A. It's just because all these guys are in A. So, let's see. Oh. So, well, by the subset axioms, B is a set. Because all that's really going on here, until something is nailed down, like actually running into the ordinal alpha, is that we're just talking. Manners of speaking. We have this operation H that we're able to say. Here it's actually turned into, or given rise to, an object. Subset axiom. The set B is a set, but then for each A in B, there is a unique ordinal beta subset A equals A beta, and that's another operation. So we have the way of saying, we just said that. So we have operation, I don't know, we'll call it K. K of A equals the unique beta such that A equals A beta. We have K of A is defined for all A and B, so, right, that, because B was defined that way. B was precisely the members of A such that they're, I don't know why I use that notation, it's the same as saying H of beta equals A beta. It's a set of members of A that are of the form A beta for some beta. Turn it around. You have the operation K that takes such an A and gives you the beta. So, as I said, it's going to be by the replacement axiom. Let's do it here. By a replacement axiom, the set of K of A and B is a set. And I guess I did it in the more grandiose way, but the issue was whether or not we stop. We stop mainly because, as this argument is giving an instance of, the ordinals are not a set. Is a class, it is not a set. If you actually look back at the argument why the ordinals is not a set, it's really a strangely close thing. If it were a set, it would actually be an ordinal. And hence, it produces one more object that this class ordinals is supposed to have, and it'll be a new ordinal. And so this is kind of a very expansive type of class, very, very jealous about whenever sets appear that are like it, they go into it. But anyway, the ordinal is a class, it's not a set, but if B, what did I just do? If there is no alpha such that H of alpha equals the default, then ords S equals the set of K of A and B is a set. Contradiction. All right, so that's one way to argue for the fact that there is an alpha like that. I just did it that way, I suppose. By the way, so having argued for that, so hence, we're done. There is an alpha such that H restricted to alpha maps alpha 1-1 onto A. That was the only issue. I got to admit for myself, there's something slightly uncomfortable about the way I presented this thing, because we just let the transfinite recursion go without any built-in expectations that that it was going to stop. The prototype for the argument we gave, if we just did it for like over omega instead of all the ordinals, was the thing about start with a set and start picking more and more elements from it. If it's finite, eventually you'll run into its cardinality and we'll get a 1-1 map from that to it. If it's infinite, we'll just produce more and more elements through all of omega and then stop. In that case, if we actually started with a finite set, we'd be able to predict where we stopped. The set, finite set, it's finite, it's got a cardinality, there's some n that is its cardinality, and what we were doing was known to stop by n. You can view the argument we just done in that way, so I might as well just say that remark. We could have found kind of up front an ordinal alpha such that we know up front there is no 1-1 function from alpha to A. Hence, we know we would have known up front that we will run into an ordinal alpha such that the operation gives us the default. Just because we should know up front, there's lots and lots and lots of ordinals. And depending on what we're doing, we should be able to predict where some process like this would stop. So that's Hertog's theorem. Oops, it's the ordinary H, I suppose. Hertog's theorem. For a set, there is an ordinal alpha such that alpha cannot be mapped 1-1 into A. No 1-1 function from alpha to A is the same as saying alpha cannot be mapped 1-1 into A. Yeah. The proof is essentially the same in some sense as what we did at that last part of this argument. We'll just do it outside of the context of the recursion, namely proof. Let's look at them. Look at ordinals beta such that beta can be mapped into A. So, i.e., look at functions f mapping beta to A 1-1. That means, let's look at the image of these. Look at, say, C equal the range of F. The function F gives a well ordering of C. The very fact that you have a 1-1 F, what is F now? By taking the range, F is mapping beta 1-1 onto C. So F gives a well ordering of C, namely what's called less than F. C1 is less than F C2 if and only if C1 equals F of gamma 1, C2 equals F of gamma 2, and gamma 1 is less than gamma 2. This is the ordering of ordinals. So we have a well ordering here because beta is an ordinal. We just transfer it over. Gives a well ordering, what did I call it? C less than F. And that tells us what F is, by the way. I have room up here, so I'll go in this direction. F inverse from C to beta gives the epsilon image of C less than F. Well, this thing is a well order. It's a well order because it's an isomorphic copy of beta. And these are all just the same ways of saying that. We have a 1-1 onto map. Anything happening from one side can be transferred to the other by just copying, which is what we just did. We have beta as an ordinal, so a well ordering. Therefore, we have a well ordering here. And in fact, epsilon image is the name for that. What good does that do? And I'm almost done. So now look at, let's call it D, the set of all these things. C less than, such that C is a subset of A, and less than is a well order of A. So we're just examining the notion, and possible for each set A, we're trying to show there's so many ordinals that there's going to be one big enough not to be, so big that it can't be mapped 1-1 into A. How do we do it? Well, basically by subset axioms, we can anticipate where anybody who does map 1-1 from an ordinal could possibly go. Here they are in the ordinals, that's outside of A, but once you have the map in, you look at the part that's inside A, you look at the structure that it gives, and now you've got stuff inside of A which can somehow, on its own, figure out where it came from. Look at all of those things. D is a set. The same thing as in the last argument. We're just doing the usual things here. Here's A, C's, members of the power set of A. Less than is a subset of C cross C or A cross A, so it's a subset of power set of A cross A. Looking at pairs of those, etc. it's a set. We just said which, exactly what it is, and we can figure out a set from where all the possible members come from. D is a set, and so the set of all beta such that beta equals the epsilon image of C less than, let's just call that, I guess. Did I just waste my time? We have operation. That's my preferred way of saying these things. The operation, epsilon image, let's call it E. E of C less than equals, this is for C less than a well ordering. For C less than a well ordering, what's what epsilon operation script E is equals unique ordinal beta such that beta equals the epsilon image of C less than, right? It's an operation. So since D is a set, and once again, the replacement axioms gives us that the set of epsilon images of the things in D, I guess that's a pair, is a set. Actually, we can just call this alpha. So alpha's a set of ordinals. Beta in alpha implies beta is a subset of alpha, since after all, anything smaller than beta is simply the epsilon image of the appropriate segment of C. So, in fact, alpha itself is an ordinal. So we've just done all these things to actually produce the canonical object that we're supposed to know about in advance. And what ordinal is this? Alpha equals the first ordinal such that alpha cannot be mapped 1-1 into A. Because that's precisely what we just analyzed. We looked at ordinals that could be mapped 1-1 in A. Notice again, anything smaller ordinal than this, willy-nilly, gets mapped in 1-1 into A too. That's why this step, this just means gamma less than beta implies gamma is less than alpha. That's all it means. If beta is in alpha, all the stuff ordinals less than beta go along too. If beta can be mapped 1-1 into A, any smaller ordinal can be mapped 1-1 into A, this is what this is. The set alpha simply is all those betas and all the smaller ones. So alpha simply is this downward closed set of ordinals. That makes it an ordinal itself, given that it's a set. And it willy-nilly is simply produced to literally be the betas. So, you know, it's the first ordinal there. And so how did it appear into a set? We're able to use our axioms for that. The subset axioms produce the prototypes from objects that are close to the set A itself, and the replacement axiom then gives us the epsilon images. Okay. Anyway, and I probably went over. There's something else I wanted to say here, but you know, probably a bit later I can do it. So, okay. We paid one debt. For some reason, it took a lot longer than I thought.